Wilhelm!
Yeah, I'll just fill my pipe.
Kill them. Kill them both. We're missing Antiques Roadshow.
Aren't you ever dramatizing this situation?
We're interrupting this program to bring you the most exciting piece of news that's happened since the war.
Like magic, an invisible chain of sound once more circles the planet.
Anything can happen in the next hour.
Who else has electricity streaming from his eyeballs and from his fingers?
Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Talking about cause and effect in the outside world. We're not living in the outside world.
You know, it's a pity you weren't born a girl.
Yes, I've always envied you that.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast looks at movies between 1895 and 1990. We cover all mainstream and genre films, books, TV, and whatever else Terry gets obsessed about. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The new voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can leave messages on Skype at Paleo Cinema. All lowercase and no dash. This podcast may include swearing and adult content, so if you hear anything you don't understand, just fucking Google it.
Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 71. Yes, this is Terry Frost, and this time around we are looking at two of the coolest criminals of the 1960s. The first movie I'm going to talk about is a kind of forgotten crime classic, and I think it's a classic because it's a very stylish little piece of work, called Johnny Cool, starring Henry Silver, Elizabeth Montgomery, Sammy Davis Jr., Joey Bishop, and pretty much anybody in the Rat Pack who wasn't Sinatra or Dean Martin. And the second movie is another one which is an undoubted classic. There's no ambiguity about it at all, and that would be the 1967 Lee Marvin starring John Borman directed crime film Point Blank. So I'm going to enjoy this one this time because both of the films are incredibly cool, and there's a fair bit to say about them. So how is everybody? I'm on vacation. First time since 2008. I shit you not, early 2008 was the last time I took any time off. And I've got 3 weeks off. It's going to be fantastic. I'm going to spend 2 weeks in two other towns, just to use a movie reference. It's now Saturday as I record, and on Tuesday night, Sal and I are flying up to Darwin in the Northern Territory, right at the top of Australia, for a week. And I'm going to do live in-studio radio with Ivor Cole at ABC Darwin, which is going to be a groovy thing. I've never done a kind of face-to-face in a radio studio before, so I'm looking forward to that. And then we come back, and then we head to Broken Hill for a week up there. We're going to visit the Mad Max Museum in Silverton and do a few art galleries and stuff, cruise around a little bit, and in general have an incredibly groovy time. Come back, have a few days off before we head back to work. I hope everyone's doing well. I believe the Northern Hemisphere is still suffering from cold weather, which, sucks to be you. But here it's Melbourne got this weird summer where it was rainy all the time and the temperatures didn't get anywhere up to where they normally get to. And so I'm looking forward to actually getting some summer weather when I go up to Darwin. And it's starting to get cooler again, which I kind of dislike. I always bitch about it, you know that. But things have been going fine. Haven't been doing too much. We've been in that kind of pre-vacation, waiting for it to happen. When's it going to happen? Why the fuck isn't it holidays already, kind of thing? And so we haven't been doing too much there. I have watched some movies, and I'll just get the old Mizzo going here just to update you on what I've been watching. I'll go backwards from the most recent onwards. I'm getting a little bit better at putting all of the movies that I watch on Mizzo. It's just a matter of getting in the habit of it, really. But we'll check this out. I'm just waiting for it to load up now, which makes for riveting radio. Watch Thunderball again because it was on TV. like Thunderball. Yeah, I might talk too much about that. Everyone knows about that. I did see Resident Evil Afterlife, which basically the Resident Evil movies, being based on a computer game, are very long animatic sequences for computer games. Yeah, Mila Jovovich is always cool in there. Ellie Larder's in this one. A bunch of other people. Shitloads of CGI. Some very cool action scenes. But it's, you know, it's kind of like, okay, cool action. What else is there? Nothing. So I got a bit of that. I did watch the Oscars as well, because I always do. And yeah, there's a lot of bitching about James Franco and Anne Hathaway, and I think the kind of let's get the kids in to do a show kind of thing didn't quite work. But yeah, I've got to give the Academy all credit for trying something new and different. I really think that that's important. You learn as much from failures as you do from successes, and I like that. They rolled out Kirk Douglas at 94, and since he had his stroke in 1996, it is difficult to understand him, but he is the poster boy for bouncing back from that sort of thing. And even though it was a little bit creepy watching him flirt with Anne Hathaway, you've got to admire the fact that the guy still wants to. He wasn't the oldest person at the Oscars either. Eli Wallach's a year older than him, and he was given a special Oscar as well. He was there still motoring on. I mean, he was in The Ghost Rider this year, so he's still a jobbing actor at the age of 94. I mean, him, Ernest Borgnine, and Kirk Douglas should do a buddy picture. That's what I figure, you know, basically not a generic action flick would be an incredibly cool thing. I'm not too sure whether or not they would do their own stunts, but I think the concept's there, and as long as one of them didn't drop off the twig in the middle of the film, I really think it could work. I really think that the world is ready for an action film starring three 90-year-olds, well, 90-odd-year-olds, so, you know, there you go, Hollywood. If you want that as a concept, give me a little bit of a credit. Take me out there for a trip, and you can have the idea. So, but apart from that, yeah, the obvious films won. There wasn't anything really controversial about the winners. Nominees, it was good to see a little bit of variety in there, and some of the smaller films get nominees in some of the categories. And somebody that I've met actually won an Oscar. Now, this is bragging, and I know a lot of people don't like this, but I was very happy to see Sean Tan get the Best Animated Short Feature Oscar for The Lost Thing. Very incredible piece of work, and Sean is an inspired artist, and apart from that, he is a very nice guy, and it is really interesting to see him up there with everybody else, and deservedly so. He's an incredible talent at what he does, and I do hope that he does more film type work as well as the marvelous work he does in his books. So all credit to Sean, and everyone in Western Australia was cheering when he won, because he's a free metal boy, and all strength to him for that. Let's see what else I watched. I did watch Hello Down There. Rupert recommended this one to me. It's a kind of comedy thing starring Tony Randall and Janet Leigh, Jim Backus and Richard Dreyfuss, about a guy who decides to test the concept of an underwater house by taking his family to live in an underwater house. Now, this is one of those 1960s studio pictures where, kind of like the Oscars, they're trying to capture the youth market. So they brought in a couple of teenage kids to be the children, and of course, one of them has a pop band where Richard Dreyfuss happens to be the bass guitarist. And, yeah, they've got seals and dolphins and silliness and Tony Randall and Janet Leigh trying to keep control of things. And in general, it's a weird little film, mostly because it kind of goes for the zeitgeist of 1969, and instead it kind of fails miserably. But in that failure, it's kind of interesting in a way, which is it's a kind of artifact of its time very much, and it's one of those things with the kind of flows over you. It's not going to be fantastic, it's not going to be outstandingly memorable, it's not going to blow you away in any way, but the cool thing was Roddy McDowall played a record producer in his film, and his name, see, this is how that they were really tapping into the youth market, his name, I shit you not, was Nate Ashbury rather than Haight Ashbury. So that shows you the kind of level of wit shown by that film. Thanks for that, Rip, but I'll keep watching your recommendations, mate, but you owe me one. But, yeah, apart from that, let's see what else we've got on the list. I'll just kind of click back through it, which, again, is great listening for everybody out there. Ta-ta-ta. I did see Devil, the 2010 thing produced by M. Night Shyamalan, and I'm not going to make fun of his name. I mean, it's not fair to do that. But, yeah, a little thriller. People trapped in an elevator. The devil seems to be in there with them. Cops are watching on the closed-circuit cameras. Blah, blah, blah. Figured out who the devil was pretty damn quick. And there was a little bit at the end which was very much a kind of Christian propaganda bit right at the end, which I didn't really appreciate. Yeah, it should have gone direct to video. And I think the only reason it got a theatrical release at all was M. Night Shyamalan's name on there. I did see a very cool little thriller from very early 1960s called Cover Girl Killer, starring Ari H. Corbett as a really sick fuck who is killing girls who appear on the covers of magazines. It's one of those low-budget British crime things. A little bit of titillation, but no tit, from very early 1960s. And Harry H. Corbett playing a killer who disguises himself by putting on a bad toupee and Coke bottle glasses before he kills girls. Yeah, it's an interesting one. It's always nice to see exploitation films from the past and really groove on them. I did see a very good film, The Rise and Rise of Michael Rimmer, starring Peter Cook as a time and motion marketing expert who basically works his way up to becoming the dictator of the UK. A lot of comedy in there, a little bit of nudity, which is always really appreciated by me, of course, and some great pieces by different English character actors. Ronnie Corbett has a bit in it, a bunch of other stuff. But if you get a chance to see The Rise and Rise of Michael Rimmer, it's definitely worthwhile, and it's one of those films, like the first Bedazzled, that really goes to show you that it's a shame that Peter Cook's career arc didn't take him more into making more films, because I think more than Dudley Moore, he really had a personality for, well, a persona on screen that works really well on screen. I think the big problem was he was an insecure alcoholic, and of course that knocked his career arc in a cocked hat. I did see, speaking of dead people, I did see, before she died, Jane Russell in Underwater, which was a movie that was produced by Howard Hughes and also starred Richard Egan and Gilbert Rowland. And I've got a lot of time for Gilbert Rowland in movies. It's a kind of underwater adventure with people searching for treasure and getting bailed up by Mexican pirates. And there's a lot of underwater photography done by Ivan Tors and Rico Browning. And, it's kind of works. They really give the soundtrack theme music a bashing. It's a track called Cherry Pink and Apple Blossom White, which became a huge hit for Perez Prado in the 1950s. But not a time waster, a little bit of fun. The coolest thing about this movie isn't actually the movie itself. It's the fact that when they did the premiere of the movie in Florida, they did it at Coral Springs underwater, with all of the movie critics in scuba gear to watch the movie. Now, I don't know how that worked really well, because after about 40 minutes, people would have to get up and change tanks and things like that. But there's a few publicity shots around where you see all these people sitting in front of a movie screen underwater, watching underwater. So there's that. And what else did I see? I saw It's a Mad, 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 Mad World again, just to watch the ensemble going, which was pretty cool, and I did enjoy that. Every now and then I dip in and watch that, just to watch how a kind of large-scale, stunt-based, pratfall-based ensemble comedy with the best comedians of its time, just having fun there. I did see one that Dr. Zom recommended called Soldier of Fortune, which starred Clark Gable and Susan Hayward, and is set in Hong Kong. About a soldier of fortune who helps Susan Hayward get her ne'er-do-well husband out of China. He's played by Gene Barry. And the person in this film that Dr. Zon most loves is a character actor called Alexander Darcy, who's got a pencil mustache and is bare-chested half of the time. And really suave. Alexander Darcy was an Egyptian actor who had a career in Hollywood playing suave and swarthy motherfuckers. And, yeah, so I'm joining Dr. Zom in the Alexander Darcy Appreciation Society. So there we go. I've watched a fair few, haven't I? Let's see what else I did. I did check out Zone Troopers, the Charles Band movie from the 1980s, where a whole bunch of GIs during World War II are behind enemy lines and meet up with an alien. So that's pretty cool. It's got Tim Thomason in it, which is a lot of fun. And yeah, it's one of those ones I first caught on VHS back in the day and had a lot of time for. And the other thing I've seen is All-Star Superman, the animated Superman director DVD film, which was kind of cool. I mean, I like these DC director video things. I even like the Marvel ones where the animation isn't so good. They're always I've always got a little bit of time to spend an hour or so watching one of these things. And All-Star Superman, recommend it. See it if you like that kind of thing, and you won't be disappointed. So I'm going to take a break now because I get this tickle in my throat telling me it's about time I should take a break. And after that, I'm going to talk about the first of our two films, Johnny Cool, starring Henry Silver and Elizabeth Montgomery. Connie Francis with Vacation. I had to play that. So on to Johnny Cool. Now, if you haven't seen this film and you're into crime films, see it. It's hard to get. I'll be honest with you, it's hard to get. You can get it through the usual suspects, but if you don't have access to them, it is difficult to see. Apparently, it does turn up on TCM in America because the copy I've got has got TCM's little bug in the corner of it. It's a good print, but it's got that in there. It was directed by a guy called William Asher, who was quite interesting too. He was married to Elizabeth Montgomery, who stars in the film. And William Asher made a whole bunch of different things. He's most famous for a couple of things, being Paddy Duke Show in 1963-1964, starring, oddly enough, Paddy Duke. Gidget, the TV series with Sally Field. And then from 1964 to 1972, Bewitched, starring, of course, Elizabeth Montgomery. Now, this movie predates Bewitched by about a year. And the change between Elizabeth Montgomery's character in this film and the kind of white bread, middle class, but supernatural chick she plays in Bewitched is incredibly marked and extreme. Yeah, it's just there's a disconnect there when you compare the two. And William Asher also directed a whole bunch of beach movies as well. He made Johnny Cool, which is kind of a rock solid tough crime drama, in between making Beach Party and Muscle Beach Party, before Beach Bikini Beach, Beach Blanket Bingo, and How to Stuff a Wild Bikini. So bikinis were definitely big in his career. Johnny Cool really works. It's a black and white film, so it's got that kind of black and white street cred. I'll read you a synopsis out of IMDb, which is better than a number of the IMDb synopses that I've seen before. Let's see what I got there. Just waiting for that to load. Now, here we go. Collini, an exiled American gangster living in Sicily, rescues Giordano, a young Sicilian outlaw, from the police. After Giordano is groomed and polished and renamed Johnny Cool, Collini sends him on a vengeance mission to the United States to assassinate the men who plotted Collini's downfall and his enforced exile. Johnny arrives in New York and quickly kills several of the underworld figures on Collini's list. Meanwhile, he picks up Dare Guinness, a wealthy divorcee, who becomes his accomplice. She's severely beaten by the gangsters as a warning against the vendetta. That's basically it. So basically he's sent as a loose cannon almost by Collini, the gangster from currently living in exile in Italy, who is played by an interesting actor called Mark Lawrence, who had a career spanning well over half a century. He really was a well-known and great character. I mean, he did his last movie in 2003, and he did his first movie, he said, scrolling down through an immense number of credits this guy has, in 1932. So what's that? That's a 71-year career that Mark Lawrence had. Unfortunately, he was affected by the House Un-American Activities Committee and was blacklisted for a number of years as well. But in Johnny Cool, he is a good presence there as the kind of puppet master who aims Johnny Cool at the mafia kingpins still living in the States and living off the fat of Collini's empire. Henry Silver in this one is very good. It's fairly early in his career. A lot of people think he's in some way Asian, but Henry Silver's actually kind of half Italian, half Spanish origin. In his family, and he was born in 1928 in Brooklyn, New York. He became an actor, went to the actor studio for a while there, started out on Broadway, and then kind of went into roles. Was in Ocean's 11, so he got hooked up there with Sinatra and the Rat Pack. Of course, he was in The Manchurian Candidate, having that terrific karate fight with Sinatra. And he went on over to Europe, but of course became the man known and loved by Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema fans. If you go to the GGTMC blog site, there's a picture of Henry. There's a number of pictures of Henry Silver right over the top there. So he's definitely one of their favourites. And in this, I haven't seen him better in anything, to be honest with you. Yeah, he's done some extreme roles since then. But I think, in a lot of ways, this is my favourite of his roles that I've seen, for the simple reason that he's kind of compacted in rather than being loud and eccentric and crazy. Everything Johnny Cool does is controlled. He's got a mission. He knows what he's doing. He's moving so fast and hitting these guys so fast, bam, 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 that they think he's got a whole bunch of people behind him, whereas all he is him alone, wreaking vendetta against all of these mafia guys. And the people playing the mafia guys are quite interesting too. They've got some really interesting casting choices in this film. Jim Backus doing a serious role. Yeah, we know Jim Backus from, of course, Gilligan's Island and Mr. Magoo and all those silly kind of roles. But in this one, he's playing a kind of mafia-connected construction magnate who's doing some dodgy deals with some city councilmen in Los Angeles and things like that. And he's very good in it, too. The thing that people forget about Jim Backus is that he has been a serious actor at various times. He played the father in Rebel Without a Cause. He played James Dean's father in that and did a bloody good job of it as well. And this film's interesting from a number of different levels, one of which is the use of comedic actors in serious roles. Now, there's another actor in it who's known for kind of light comedy kind of things, an actor called John MacGyver. You might remember he's the guy who had the Crackerjack toy monogrammed for Audrey Hepburn in Breakfast at Tiffany's, kind of rotund actor. And he does a very different role in this film as well. He's playing the boss of a casino who has a great scene with an actress where she's had a few bounced checks at the casino and he's telling her she's going to have to pay it off and not actually explicitly stating how she's going to have to pay it off, but the implication's pretty strong there, and it's quite a shocking role for an actor I've only ever seen in comedy stuff. There's also a great scene with John MacGyver for the American kind of comedy satirist Mort Sahl. He does a good dramatic role, not a big role, but like a lot of the other actors in this film, they get a couple of great scenes to kind of show their acting chops, which is another reason why this film is an interesting one. There's a scene with Sammy Davis Jr. at a crap table, which you've got to see to believe. It's quite interesting and full tilt boogie as well. And this film has just got that kind of 1960s Rat Pack, Las Vegas, made man, tailored suit kind of style to it, which is really enhanced by the soundtrack of the film, which is by Billy May, who was an arranger and composer who did a lot of work with Sinatra and people like that. Big brassy sound kind of things. I'll play a bit of the audio from Johnny Cool, where Telly Savalas, who also is in this movie, has a scene with Henry Silver.
You don't look like him. How are you related?
I'm not.
You're his man.
I'm no one's man. I'm Johnny Collini.
You want in?
I already am.
You're a stranger to it.
Not anymore. Not after the last few days.
Very violent. He chose you well. All right. We'll use you. We'll do us all some good.
I'm not here for a job.
You're like we were in the beginning. We drink on it?
I'm here to take it all.
All of what? I thought you knew something.
You want names, places? How about I give you the locations in Turkey or Mexico where it's grown? Or the name of the importer in Marseille? And which of his ships brings it in? The pharmaceutical houses in Milano that process it into H? Or if that's all too far away, how about the name of the wholesale jobber over in Jersey who handles over a ton of Benzedrine a month?
You talk like a mystery story. Here we're legitimate business. Everything legal.
I know. That's why I want the unissued stock in the six corporations, all of it, signed over to me. The New York contracting interests, the Vegas setup, the Coast Oil you can keep if you retire.
And if I don't?
Then I take that too.
You won't get what you want by using violence with us.
You got yours with a gun.
Way back in the beginning? Yes.
Then I'll get mine as you got yours. I'm giving you 24 hours to deliver the unissued stock to the trust department of the Chase National Bank in my name.
If I lift my hand, you die. Here, in this room right now.
What difference does that make? You think I'm here alone?
And that scene gets to the crux of the movie. Johnny Cool is moving so fast, he goes from New York to Los Angeles to Las Vegas. He moves around so fast that these mafia guys think that he's got a big organization behind him. It can't just be one guy doing all of this mayhem. And that's the strength and ultimately the weakness of Johnny Cool. The fact that people believe he's got an organization behind him when he hasn't. He's just running madly and fast to get this vendetta done, which makes for an interesting thing. It's kind of a weird, dark overturning of Robin Hood. He's stealing from the rich and nasty and not giving to anybody. But basically, he's kind of hitting them fast. It's a guerrilla war in an urban setting almost, which is a crazy concept, but it really does work. And Elizabeth Montgomery's role in this is interesting. He meets her in a bar in New York, and they hook up with each other. The mafia finds out that she's hooked up with him, has a couple of gangsters rape her, and he then basically cuts the nuts off the gangsters. It's not explicitly stated, but that's what they mean in this film. That he basically grellocks the bastards and as a revenge thing, and then moves on. And she becomes kind of codependent with him. She's kind of hooked on him, which ultimately leads to his downfall. Now, one of the things I've said about this film, I did write briefly about it in Rupert Pupkin Speaks, Rupert's blog. One of the things I said about this film is that the message of the film is don't fuck with the mafia or they will do things to you that don't happen in the Saw franchise. And that's the case. Ultimately, the mafia get him. It's not a spoiler particularly. I'm not going to give you the details because you can enjoy them yourself. But wow, this film's dark at the end, and it really is interesting. And the thing is that the police are invisible all through this. It's a gangster world that this film sets up, which really kind of puts it in a space of its own. It's there's a lot of location shooting for a lot of things. Some of it's studio. In the room scenes are studio based, but there's a lot of location shooting, which gives it a slightly documentary feel. But it's a weird, dark kind of alternate universe almost that gets created by this film. And it works really well for that. It's not a large budget film. It doesn't have any A-list actors. There's a fantastic scene where Brad Dexter, one of the guys who played the Magnificent Seven, gets whacked by Johnny Cool, which I'm not going to spoil, but it's a very interesting way of doing the job. And very kind of Los Angeles way of doing the job, if you know what I mean, if you've seen the film. But Brad Dexter basically got his career really kick-started because he was in Hawaii and saved Frank Sinatra from drowning off a beach in Hawaii. So he was kind of set up pretty well after that. And he did appear in a couple of Rat Pack films as well, but yeah, this film's a fantastic little artifact of the 1960s, and that's one of the things I'm not sure about with people who release DVDs and movie programmers as well for TV is how aware they are of what's out there as far as cinema's concerned. You've got to have such a breadth of knowledge, and there's so vastly much to know about film, even just if you stick to American films of a certain era. There's just so many different films there that unless you've got it, you're kind of all over it, at least in a facile kind of way, it's very easy to miss on a film like Johnny Cool. It wasn't widescreen, it wasn't colour, it didn't have big names in it, but it's a fucking solid gangster film. And really interesting because of that and because of the subsequent careers and its unusual use of comedic actors. It's a film that, you know, it was made to make money, of course, like all the films of the time really were that got any kind of release. But I think the choices made in making this film make it a really interesting one. Now, even the title role, Henry Silver in this kind of role, he was known as kind of the karate guy from Manchurian Candidate, of course, and a few other things, and from his role in Ocean's 11. But wasn't a big name actor. He had good training, which his subsequent career, the length of his subsequent career, of course, pans out. If you're a shit actor, even if you are, you have that look that Henry Silver has, you're not going to get the work unless you've got a solid grounding somewhere behind you in your history. And Henry Silver definitely has that. So I'm now going to play you the theme song sung by Sammy Davis Jr. from Johnny Cool. And leave it with that and take another break. And when I get back, we're going to be talking about a severely cool 1960s gangster film, which kind of marries up film noir, gangster films, and the French New Wave all in one extremely stylish parcel, being John Borman's 1967 Point Blank.
This is the story of Johnny Cool. It tells the tale of his life. They say Johnny was meant to be and content to be mixed up in sorrow and strife. He lived by the gun and by the knife.
Johnny Cool, Johnny Cool.
He lived by the gun and by the knife.
Johnny Cool, Johnny Cool.
If you were friendly to Johnny Cool, you were just playing the fool. They say Johnny was friend to none, friend to only one. He went by this simple rule, that his only friend was Johnny Cool.
Johnny Cool, Johnny Cool.
Yes, his only friend was Johnny Cool.
Johnny Cool, Johnny Cool.
Because he thought life had abused him, he went on a murderous fling. But he didn't know that they used him like any old puppet on a string.
Johnny Cool.
Love never mattered to Johnny Cool. Each doll to him was the same, till one babe blinked her eyes at him, sighed some sighs at him, his icy heart turned to flame. And Johnny was never quite the same.
Johnny Cool,
Johnny Cool,
Johnny Cool.
One day they caught up with Johnny Cool, just like they promised they would. They left real fear of death in him, and some breath in him. They beat him till he understood. He paid for his evil ways, but good. And so ends the story of a fool.
Johnny Cool.
The fool that was known as Johnny.
Okay, let's look at Point Blank for a while. If you haven't seen this film, definitely do so. If you're able to, definitely get the DVD version. Now, it's out of print, but if you can find one around, the US pressing of a DVD of this film, which obviously begs for a couple of things, one of which is a Criterion Edition, and another thing is a decent Blu-ray release of it. Get it. It's fantastic. The widescreen works really well. The only versions I've seen on television of this film are in pan and scan, and the prints are a bit muddy, so I don't see it anyway. I mean, if you can't get it any other way, please see it. But the DVD version is just so much better, and it's of course in the original aspect ratio that John Borman at the time wanted the film to be shown in. So I'll just do a bit of a synopsis on it, talk about who's in the film, and we go from there. Let's have a look. The synopsis in IMDb is a bit thin. After being double-crossed and left for dead, a mysterious gangster called Walker single-mindedly tries to retrieve the rather inconsequential sum of money that was stolen from him. Now, that's a bit of a shit pricey, really, because it's $93,000, and in those days it was not an insignificant amount of money compared to the amounts of money the other criminals in the film were making. It is, but in real terms, it's a fair bit of money. And, I mean, you could easily buy a couple of houses for that if you shopped around at the time in 1967. So, again, it's a fair whack of dough. But the basic premise is that Walker's left for dead after a money delivery at Alcatraz Island goes wrong. A helicopter comes in and dumps some mob money or some crap like that in at Alcatraz. Walker, played by Lee Marvin, is portrayed by his best friend, a character called, Mal Reese, played by John Vernon. And they shoot him and leave him for dead in Alcatraz. Walker swims to shore from Alcatraz, which takes a lot of doing. And if anybody can essay somebody who can is capable of swimming from Alcatraz to San Francisco with a couple of bullets in him, it's got to be Lee Marvin. I'll talk a little bit more about why later. And anyway, Walker just goes on a rampage, kind of like Johnny Cool, but with a much more personal goal, which is to get the $93,000 off the criminals. Along the way, his wife, played by Sharon Acker. Okay, before I go into that kind of stuff, there's an ambiguity about this film. There's a possibility that all the subsequent scenes in the film after the Alcatraz Island bit are a dying dream of Walker's, a dream of revenge as he lays dying in an abandoned prison cell in Alcatraz. That's one interpretation of the film. Now, in the commentary track, John Borman says that that is an interpretation of the film. He doesn't actually put his money either way on whether it's a Walker escapes and goes on a rampage or whether it's actually Walker's last dying dream. But he says that the intention is there for that to be the case. And fine, too. I mean, I like a movie that doesn't give you a very straightforward view of reality, and this is definitely that. His sister-in-law, anyway, Walker meets his sister-in-law, Chris, played by Angie Dickinson, and they have some fantastic scenes together, and a criminal called Yost, played by Keenan Wynn. Now, Yost is an ambiguous character. Yost can be interpreted a number of different ways. And also the other criminals, Lloyd Bochner, Carol O'Connor, playing a very un-Archie Bunker kind of role in this, a hired gun played by James Seeking, who's very cool, and basically a bunch of other people. Now I'm going to play a bit of audio from the film and then go into a little more detail on it, because this is one of the great crime films, bar none, and the fact that it's a very eccentric one actually elevates it rather than distracts from the fact that it's a crime film.
Waiting.
It's a setup.
They're spreading the word now. They want you to try and get him.
Where is he?
The Huntley, place run by the organization.
Where would he be?
All the way up, the penthouse.
Oh?
He always uses it.
What's it like?
Fort Knox.
You've been there.
Once, to see Lynn.
That goes up to the top?
There's another elevator. Inside the lobby, goes up to the other penthouse.
They got two? What's the roof like?
Flat, open. Look at it. Men everywhere. You're gonna have a lot of trouble getting in. But you'll never get out.
And, of course, is Angie Dickinson playing Chris, talking to Walker about one of the strongholds of the gangsters that he's going to get into to try to get his money back. So, basically, this film is a beautiful, lush-looking movie. I've watched a bit of it with the sound off, and the visuals are mesmerizing. It's somebody once said that this film is a combination of film noir, gangstery things, and French New Wave, because there are long silences in the film as action goes on. There's a kind of disjunction. There's flashbacks and flash forwards and all sorts of bits. When Walker performs a violent action, there are momentary half-second or one-second bits of previous times in the film where he's performed a similar action, just a kind of flashback, almost like a Vietnam veteran gets to a previous thing. So the film constantly references things that have gone on before where we're up to in the film, which makes it... it enhances it a lot, and... One of the other beautiful things about this film is the way that people are positioned in the frame in various scenes, where you see Lee Marvin standing and how he's standing and what he's doing while he's standing and where his eyes are going while he's standing, brings this incredible power to the film. Lee Marvin's Walker is a predator. You see him, he's misleading too. He'll look one way and then act another way and do things. And, you know, I mean, the guy's got a lot of credibility too. As I've said in a previous podcast, I think, where I've mentioned Lee Marvin, he was in the Battle of Saipan during World War II, and he's like 19 years old. Most of his platoon got killed. I think it may have been one or two other people survived from his whole platoon. And he got shot in the arse, and his sciatic muscle got severed. So the guy's a genuine... He's been in battle, and he's a genuine war hero. He's one of that generation that saved the world from fascism. And that kind of gives him a gravitas that a lot of wannabe actors don't have. He's always portrays to me the air of somebody who's got nothing to prove. He does what he has to do. He does what he wants to do. He's focused, and he has nothing to prove. I mean, not in every role. I mean, he wasn't too focused playing Ben Rumson in Paint Your Wagon. In fact, he was singularly unfocused by a number of things. But visually, this film is beautiful too. There's a scene where Walker's in a car watching his wife walk up a flight of stairs. And it's just a beautiful way, the way he's framed in the scene and the cut back to his wife ascending a staircase. The look of this film is great because the director, John Borman, was an Englishman. This was his first American film. The only previous feature film he made was a black and white musical in England in the mid-60s called Catch Us If You Can, which was kind of trying to do what Help done for the Beatles for the Dave Clark Five, another English Britpop band. The film was really good and successful. Borman then went to Los Angeles and convinced MGM to let him make this film, which is kind of cool. And the studio executives watched the film and just didn't know what they had. They were talking about recuts and all sorts of things, but one of the film editors just told them, don't touch this film, leave it as it is. This film has something, and it's, you know, if you cut it, you're going to be ruining it. So this female film editor, who had a lot of respect, had gained a lot of respect from the people in the studio, had her way, and basically the film stayed the way it was. There's a number of things to watch in this film from a film buff's viewpoint that are fantastic. Now, back to what I was saying about it being an English director doing his first American film. The interesting thing about non-American directors doing American films set in American cities is they have a particular eye for the unusual. They don't... Things that Americans take for granted about American cities aren't what a visitor to America sees in an American city. The things that are invisible because they've always been there are not invisible to, for instance, me when I went to the States. I saw unusual things there that nobody else was noticing. Just the way signs are set up on billboards, the way walls are, the way buildings are constructed. I watched somebody renovating an old house in San Francisco, and that kind of chipboard that they use to layer the walls isn't something I'd seen before. Just those kind of detail are what Borman brings to this film. The way that America is viewed is not an American's eye, and that helps with this film to kind of work towards giving us a sense of Walker, the character, as an outsider, because the director himself is an outsider to the place where he's filming the movie, which does work incredibly well. It is an eye. It's just the eye that this movie is seen through is different than you'd get from an American director. And that's the virtue of directors making films internationally rather than just within their own nation, that fact that what they bring to the game is difference and is a new way of seeing things, and very much so John Borman does in this film. Now, one of the other things I like about Lee Marvin is the fact that he was a character actor for just about 15 years before he hit it big with movies like The Killers and Point Blank and The Dirty Dozen, and movies like that. He was one of those kind of mid-career successes rather than somebody who was a big star very young and was playing catch-up for the rest of their life. He got big later on, and those qualities that people like Fritz Lang saw in him when he made the big Heat and made Lee Marvin the villain in that, and John Sturges saw in him when he cast him in Bad Day at Black Rock, are the things as the 1960s rolled along that people were looking for in a protagonist in a movie, and Lee Marvin filled that role. Again, like so many people I talk about in this podcast, Lee Marvin was a person who was affected by alcohol a lot, and it did shorten his life and things, but he was an intelligent man, and he was a very astute man as well. In the commentary track on this film, John Borman does the commentary track with Steven Soderbergh, who thanks Borman for all the bits that Soderbergh has pinched from Borman's Point Blank to use in his movies, particularly, I suppose, the Ocean's movies. But one of the things that Borman said during that commentary track was that a lot of the really interesting ideas were done in collaboration with Lee Marvin. Borman's approach was to make him a kind of partner in direction. And a lot of the beautiful bits and pieces that you see in this film, the atypical actions and the way they convey the thought processes and the mind of the Walker character, were very much a collaboration between Borman and Lee Marvin, because they got the original script for the movie and they were sitting around talking about it, and you know, Borman said to Marvin, "What do you think?" And he said, "Hate the script, love the character." And they kind of went from it from that point of view. And they made for a studio picture, MGM did some interesting things in the late 60s. The studio wasn't doing well. They'd had their heyday in the 40s and 50s with musicals and other big films and things like that, but they weren't doing particularly well in the 60s, and ultimately they crashed. But towards the end there, they were trying new things. They were trying to find what would work to save themselves as a studio, as an organization, to save all those jobs, to save that fantastic backlot, to save that immense wealth of sets and costumes and props and things they had there. And Point Blank was very much a part of that, just like Zabriskie Point was. Zabriskie Point was made by MGM in collaboration, of course, with Antonioni. But they were trying new things. And that, anybody that does that really does get some credit with me. They tried some interesting things that weren't always a success. I mean, this movie costs $3 million to make, and in its theatrical release, only made $3.5 million, so it wasn't really a cash cow. But it's played in rentals on TV and other places really well over time. And it's a shame they don't have a new DVD release. The DVD release is a good one, very much so. But I think a Blu-ray release would be great to have on this as well. And the commentary track with Soderbergh and Borman talking about the film and just talking about filmmaking as they do so is a treasure. I love commentary tracks where I learn more about film just by having two incredibly knowledgeable people who've spent their careers in the business just discussing why something was done a certain way, why in the scenes with Lloyd Bochner and Lee Marvin did they choose to have a green colour palette in the film? And one of the things Borman says too is that the colours got warmer and hotter through this film. It was a deliberate thing for them to end up at the kind of make things a bit richer and redder towards the end of the film than the kind of yellowy colours they had at the start at Alcatraz. And Alcatraz is a great set for a movie, as people who've seen The Rock would know. And it's a great place to visit, too. I found it very depressing when I visited it, personally. But I can appreciate there's an atmosphere to the place and an intensity and a density to Alcatraz because of the layers of history, what occurred in that particular place, the kind of ramshackle state it's in now, and the fact that you get that sense of unease partly because of knowing what's occurred there and partly because the place smells like bird shit. But Alcatraz, I kind of like. And one of the things that I remember from my trip to Alcatraz is thinking, how the fuck did Lee Marvin swim to the shore from there? It's a movie buff kind of moment to have, and when you visit new places where movies have been set, it's an inevitable thing for you to compare the reality to the movie, and that's exactly what I did in this case. But this film is good. The scene where Angie Dickinson attacks Lee Marvin, I'm not going to describe it more than that, was apparently quite cathartic for Angie Dickinson because her and Marvin didn't get on particularly well. He'd dangled her out of a window, I think, in The Killers, and for some reason they weren't on friendly terms, so that antagonism between them really peppers that scene with an intensity that it might not have had otherwise. And you've got to see it. I'm not going to do a spoiler on that. And I'm not going to do a spoiler about the very apt ending the film has either. It's got the kind of ending that, for me, enhances the idea of Walker as a predator, Walker as a hunting animal, as much as he is a man. And, you know, he's a man with feelings. The scenes with his wife and the flashbacks and the other bits and pieces in this film really do show that he's not just a cardboard cutout. They try to flesh out the character of Walker, which is great. I mean, the movie was based on a novel by Donald Westlake, which is a good novel, The Hunter. It's been made recently into a graphic novel, so the actual base material was good. The script that was brought from that base material and given to Borman and Marvin wasn't. So I'm not trying to dismiss Donald Westlake's work. He was writing under one of his pseudonyms, Richard Stark, at the time, but it's a good, solid novel. I read it once upon a time. Unfortunately, I don't still have a copy of it. I've got other Westlake novels here in the library, but not that one. And yeah, please see this film. It's a beautifully intense, tight, and disjointed film, and it does have the virtue of being one of the first Hollywood movies to ever have someone kicked in the balls. So that's a scene to look for as well. There are little bits where I look at it and think, yeah, that didn't quite work. That tiny little bit didn't quite work. But I know what they're going for, and I admire them for going for it. But those moments aren't very often, and I can be picky about those sort of things at times. But anyway, that's it. I'm going to play another little bit of audio from the film, and then we'll move on to the feedback.
Lee sold us a certain sum. He paid it back. Any debt he has to you is his problem, not ours.
It's your problem now.
Let me tell you about Reese.
Reese is dead. They're scraping his body up off the sidewalk in front of the Hyundai.
Then his debt died with him, I'm afraid.
Wrong. Passed on to you.
No business corporation in the world would acknowledge a debt of that kind.
If you don't, I'll kill you.
You must be stark, staring mad. You do know who you're dealing with, don't
you? Listen to me. I want my money in 12 hours. I'll tell you where to make the drop. If you don't, you are dead.
Okay, on that scary note, on to the feedback. The first one I've got it came on to the website. It says, Dear Terry, still enjoying the podcast, wishing you a great holiday. Just wanted to say thanks for covering the Assassination Bureau. That was a few podcasts ago. I've never heard of it before, but thank you for recommending it. It is indeed a fun romp, and Diana Rigg is always a joy to look at. Looking forward to more episodes. Peace, Andrew Salindu. Thank you, Andrew. Yeah, always nice to hear from new people, so anytime, mate. Happy that we're giving you things that you like watching and you like discovering, and that's what all this is about. But I also got an interesting one from our old friend Rickster, aka Serps. I haven't heard from him in a while, so it's good to know you're still listening, Rickster, so thanks for that, mate. It says, Hello Terry, how are you? Hope the vacation goes well. I must apologize for not commenting for quite a while. It seems like I've been falling behind with everything lately, including getting a chance to listen to Paleo Cinema. I downloaded them and prefer to listen to them on me Podzilla, and only just managed to steal some time to listen to episode 69 and 70. Wonderful as always. I literally saw Barbarella for the one and only time when I rented it from a video store back in the mid-1980s, and I haven't seen it since. Therefore, I need to watch it again, obviously. I dimly recall it being a visual feast, and that 1960s groovy vibe never goes amiss. As for number 70, neither film have I seen. The Last of Sheila has already gone to the top of my queue, but sadly Belmondo in That Man from Rio does not seem to be on DVD over here. Here's hoping I can catch up with watch it online before I'm too old and decrepit to see it. As I say, love the podcast as always, but since I've been remiss in sending you comments lately, I thought I'd make up for it by issuing you a friendly challenge. Was like a challenge. This is certainly not meant to be a criticism in any way, but it does seem like paleo cinema has been focusing rather heavily on the 60s and 70s recently. Not exclusively, of course, hence your choices of Pepe Le Moko and Thunder Road, Thunder Road bear out. While no one is greater lover of those two decades of the 60s and 70s than yours truly, I thought it might be an interesting palate cleanser if you had an upcoming podcast devoted to one film from the 30s and one from the 40s. That's my challenge, and those are the only restrictions. You get to choose any two films from the 30s and 40s you like. How's that? Let me know what you think. All my best, and thanks again for the continually excellent podcast, Serps, a.k.a. Rickster. Okay, I'm going to take the challenge. It won't be next podcast on that, Serps, because next one I'm doing a music podcast. That's the one I'm getting so that I've got something to upload while I'm on holiday. But the one after that, I'll pick a 30s and I'll pick a 40s. And any feedback like that where you think I'm drifting off into a little circle of just doing the same thing, always happy to take on that feedback from anybody. I'm not only doing this for myself, I'm doing it for you guys as much as anything, actually more than I am for myself. And always happy to take on that feedback, so thank you for that. And just, you know, your wonderful kind of feedback is always nice, but getting something that pushes me a little bit is also really valuable. I'm a big boy now. I can take the criticism, and to be honest with you, I thrive if I get that criticism and that feedback. So thank you very much for that, mate. Thanks for being a good friend of the podcast by doing that too. Okay, on to the first of the two voicemails. This one's from our friend Brian in Salt Lake City, from the good old Hammockus podcast, which keeps going from strength to strength. It's got its own style, and I really think that Brian and his co-hosts are really kind of getting in the groove of doing it. Now they've done a dozen or so episodes, and if you haven't listened to it, do so. They're stretching it. I think they did an Ealing film last time, but they did Dead of Night, actually. Yeah, I remember, because I podcasted that one myself a while back. But I'll be honest with you guys, it's weird when a podcast you enjoy and that you have some kind of relationship with does a movie that you've already done for a podcast. You think, that's my film, which is utter bullshit, of course. I love hearing the diverse viewpoints of it, but the first reaction, which is entirely selfish and childish and stupid, is, that's my movie, why is he doing a podcast about it? But to be honest with you, you guys brought different things to it than I did, and I did like listening to your episode about Dead of Night. So anyway, here's Brian's voicemail, and we'll get into it.
Hey, Dark Harry, it's Brian here. So, loving the show as always. Quickly, just a response to Dr. Zalman's voicemail the other week for the Barbarella episode. I just thought it was so much fun thinking about him and his mate playing Papillon in the back garden. I remember when I was a youngin', you know, just to be allowed to stay up late when James Bond would come on the TV. And, like, staying up late would be actually staying up till like, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock. But I remember, I think it was Dr. No when Dr. No was on. And forgive me if I'm wrong, but it was, the gun was under the table. He shot someone under the table. I remember running into school the next day all excited, saying, oh, I'm going to play James Bond, play James Bond. And everybody would fight about who was going to be the guy. Basically, we just sat and pretended to shoot each other under the table. But, you know, I find that that's maybe a lost art of children actually using their imagination, but I know that's an argument that's been beaten to death. So we'll see. My wee boy Charlie is just 9 months old, and we'll see if I can make him play with a box, and we'll maybe play Papillon. I'll be Dustin Hoffman, and he can be Mr. McQueen. So anyway, so happy days on Last of Sheila. Haven't watched it yet. My brother actually recommended it to me a couple of months back. I've had it on my Netflix queue for a bit, but brings me on to Ian McShane. You know, great lad, which brings me on to Sitting Pretty, with my main man, Ollie Reed, which also brings me on to your next show, which is Point Blank, which actually had certain elements to Sitting Pretty. You know, it was basically a man, you know, just on one specific mission. He was just after one thing only, and he wasn't going to stop till he got it. But I noticed on Facebook you posted that you were watching Point Blank, and I'm excited that you're actually going to be doing a show on it. I just actually got from Amazon. Actually, Uncle Cat Chris had recommended me the graphic novel of Point Blank, actually by Richard Stark Parker. It's called The Hunter. I haven't actually got onto it yet, but you know, I thought maybe you might be interested in that. It's got some cool artwork in there. So anyway, happy days, one and all, and I'm still listening and still loving every second. Cheers.
Thanks for that, Brian. I'm glad you're going to... I did mention the graphic novel, but I think I'm going to have to add it to my wish list or add it to the stuff that Sally buys when she goes nuts on Amazon, which happens at odd times. But I did enjoy the film. And Barbarella, I do love Barbarella for all the wrong reasons and things like that. But I think kids do still have an imagination. I mean, there's no shortage of Nerf guns being sold. And I know that some of them are being sold to 35-year-old guys who live in their basements of their mum's houses. But I do know, I have seen kids around with Nerf guns, so I think they can still play those kind of games and use their imagination. I think it's to be encouraged, because I think imagination is one of the things that saves the human race from itself at various times, and having that instilled into future generations is great. I mean, kids do that in all sorts of places. I've seen footage. We have a 24-hour news channel, a very good one called ABC News 24, and I was watching some stuff in Libya and Egypt and also Iraq and things like that. And in the background, you can always see kids playing in the streets. Sometimes they're playing war games, of course, because that's what they're living in. But they're also playing other games that they make up themselves. Kids' imaginations can't be controlled. So I think Charlie's going to do fine, particularly given the fact his dad's so encouraging. So thanks for the feedback, Brian. And again, everybody, download and listen to and enjoy the Hammockus podcast. Well worthwhile. And always, Brian and his team bring something new to the game. Next voicemail.
Hey, Terry, it's Rupert. Just listening to the latest show. I've been meaning to see Last of Sheila forever. I even owned it on DVD and sold it without watching it, which is one of the most ridiculous things I do sometimes. So stupid. Anyway, curious to hear your review. But I was looking at a post from Mark Edward Hoek's blog, The Projector Has Been Drinking, which is a great blog that I like a lot. And it was an old post where he's talking about this weird movie from last year called Standing Ovation, which is like a kid's movie, like a sort of a dance thing. It's just been a big hit, sort of on the, you know, what the fuck kind of movie circuit. And he mentioned inside that post, he was talking about Troll 2, and he also mentioned the movie Hello Down There. And I was wondering if you'd ever seen that, if you'd ever considered covering it. It's just a really weird movie from I think the 60s with Tony Randall, Roddy McDowall, family living in an underwater house, if I remember. I don't know. It's very strange, but I like that Mark had mentioned it. Anyway, I just wondered if you had ever seen it, what you thought, or if you'd ever cover it. Good stuff as always, sir. Goodbye.
Thanks, Rupert. After you sent me that voicemail, I did watch the movie, and it's such a 60s studio artifact. It's really weird and wonderful in a bad way. It's like, geez, I wish I could help the bastards make this film better, because it's a bit silly, and it's got trained seals and dolphins in it popping up into the house and all sorts of other things like that. But yeah, I really liked the fact that Janet Leigh was doing a comedy. I don't think she did enough of them. I think she did okay at them. And to be honest with you, she did look pretty good in a pair of capri pants. So I did notice that when I was watching the film as well. But, Jim Backus was in that as well. And Jim Backus, of course, was in Johnny Cool. So he was there playing the boss. He was a little more kind of halfway between Thurston Howell the Third and his role in Johnny Cool in this one, playing the boss, letting the comedy roll over him rather than it being a part of him. I mean, Jim Backus was in a few good movies that I like, come to think of it. He was also in one of my favourite Jane Fonda films, Sunday in New York with Rod Taylor, and he was playing a boss in that as well. So good supporting character actor, and I did like him again in Johnny Cool, playing a more serious role, which he did very well, and he did overcome our preconceptions of him as a comedic actor, which is always a lovely thing to see in those sort of situations with actors. Let me see if I've got anything else happening here in the way of feedback. Nope, that's it. Please, I'm encouraging it, cultguru@gmail.com, cult with a K, or else to the, please send the voicemails to the usual address. You can even email them to me. I don't mind getting a little bit of an email voicemail there. It's never a problem for me to transcribe those. In fact, it's slightly easier to transcribe those. The other thing I did receive was somebody sent me a spam fax to my voicemail number. Same one I got a couple of years ago, actually. And I mean, if the person who did that is listening, which is very, very unlikely, I don't really want to go onto a Caribbean cruise out of Miami. Really not what I want to do at the moment. So please stop sending your faxes to 206-350-5440 in future. Thank you very much. Anyway, that's about it. I'm just about to record the music podcast that you're going to be hearing in 2 weeks' time. But at the moment, I've got the barbecued charcoals heating up, and I'm going to lay a slab of pork belly on them to slow roast for dinner tonight, with some baked spuds and some trimmings on the side, so that's all good too. Anyway, you'll be hearing from me in 2 weeks. When you do hear from me, I'll be in Broken Hill and enjoying the fuck out of that. Very interesting desert town out right on the western edge of New South Wales, where they film films like Mad Max and Razorback and all sorts of... the second Mad Max movie, not the first one. And a whole bunch of other stuff as well. So I'm going to groove on doing that. And anyway, thank you very much for listening. I'm off to enjoy the wonders of tropical Darwin, which doesn't look a hell of a lot like it did in that shit Baz Luhrmann movie Australia. And take care of yourselves. Enjoy your movie watching. Offer the feedback. I will be able to put some feedback in 4 weeks' time when I have the next full podcast. So send the feedback and we'll have a monster feedback episode at that stage. Thank you for listening, and everybody, look after yourselves.